From Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org, I'm Ari Snyder with the news on This Day in Maine, Friday, August 15th, 2025. Law enforcement say there is no threat to the public after a shooting in Windham Friday afternoon left one person dead, but police have so far released few other details. At a press conference Friday night in Windham, Major Lucas Hare with the Maine State Police said a lone suspect had been located, but could not confirm whether the suspect had been found alive or dead. And Hare says an emergency alert that hit phones across the state Friday afternoon had been sent in error.
That was an error with the way it was entered into the system. That was not intentional.
Hare did not say when more information would be available, but says detectives are contacting family members of those involved and that the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner will perform an autopsy. Dr. Nirav Shah, who became a household name in Maine during the pandemic, says he's considering a run for governor. As Steve Missler reports, Shah would become the seventh Democratic candidate if he does decide to run.
As director of the Maine CDC, Shah became known as an effective communicator during the uncertainty of the COVID-19 pandemic. And polls taken at the time showed many Mainers trusted his guidance, even as the pandemic response and vaccines became more political and partisan. Shah acknowledges that decisions made then might be relitigated during a campaign for governor, but he says he welcomes that debate. He also addressed speculation that he might run for the U.S. Senate, saying he's best suited in state government, which he described as a bulwark against federal overreach.
Is in this moment, states are of outsized importance. States are, and state governments are going to be where the rights of Mainers are stood up for and where our rights as a state are established and defended.
Shah, age 48, left his post at the Maine CDC in 2023 after he was appointed principal deputy director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and led the response to the bird flu. Shah resigned his post in February, shortly after anti-vaccine activist Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was confirmed Secretary of Health and Human Services. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
The high temperatures and drought conditions that have suddenly spread over much of Maine are taking a toll on the state's wild blueberry harvest. Lisa Hanscom runs Welch Farm in Roque Bluffs with her father. She says the crop was doing okay until this week, when the heat dried up the remaining blueberries. Hanscom's farm had 32 acres of wild blueberries that could have been harvested, and she estimates she will lose all but 2 acres of the crop.
But I can say in my history and in Dad's history that he can remember, and he's 76, we've never lost this much crop.
Like most wild blueberry harvesters, Hanscom does not have irrigation, so she's raking whatever suitable berries are left. The Wild Blueberry Commission of Maine says harvesters around the state are experiencing similar conditions, and that Maine's harvest will likely be smaller compared to each of the last 3 years. State officials say they have not detected any new cases of fraud involving the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. Hundreds of SNAP recipients in Maine had their accounts emptied this week by thieves operating in other states. On Friday, the Maine Department of Health and Human Services received federal approval to block most out-of-state transactions using the EBT cards that SNAP recipients use to buy food. Ian Yaffe heads the Office of Family Independence at DHHS.
Since that action was taken, we have received no new reports of thefts this morning or this afternoon, so we're still holding at approximately 300 households impacted.
SNAP recipients will still be able to use their EBT cards inside Maine as well as in New Hampshire, Vermont, and to buy groceries from online retailers. The U.S. Coast Guard says it will delay a plan to remove hundreds of navigational buoys from New England waters. As Nicole Ogrisco reports, that follows pushback from mariners and federal and state lawmakers in Maine.
The proposal called for the removal of hundreds of buoys in New England waters, including nearly 150 in the Gulf of Maine. More than 3,000 people commented. Many were harbor masters, ferry operators, and fishermen who rely on the buoys slated for removal, particularly at night or in poor weather. The Coast Guard says the buoy changes are intended to support modern navigational needs because electronic systems are more widely available and affordable. But in a letter to U.S. senators, the Coast Guard said it will slow down the project after hearing feedback and will issue a revised proposal this fall. The public will have another 2 months to comment, and then the process will repeat. Changes will be implemented no earlier than 2026. Another effort to potentially remove some 2,700 buoys from harbors along the New England coast will be announced incrementally and over the next 4 years. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Nicole Ugrisco.
Acadia National Park had its busiest July in decades. That's despite a decline in international tourism and a smaller full-time staff. Michael Livingston reports.
The National Park Service says nearly 800,000 people came to explore Acadia, about 6,000 more than in July 2024. That's according to data on the NPS website. Maine tourism officials have reported drops in Canadian visitors, partly because of shifting opinions on the U.S. after tariff threats from the Trump administration. But visits to national parks have been trending high since the COVID-19 pandemic. 8 full-time staff were laid off in February as part of cuts proposed by the Department of Government Efficiency. The park was still able to hire a seasonal staff. Acadia typically sees over 4 million tourists per year. The busiest July on record was back in 1989, when the park saw over 1 million visitors. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Michael Livingston.
One of President Trump's first actions in office was to roll back diversity, equity, and inclusion programs through executive orders. Since then, DEI initiatives have faced scrutiny and backlash in higher education and in the workplace, with some companies ending them altogether. Against that backdrop, the 4th annual Inclusion Maine Conference this week brought together hundreds of participants who say they're more committed than ever to prioritizing DEI. Maddie Smith has more.
In a crowded conference room at the Holiday Inn in downtown Portland, more than 500 professionals from across the state are debriefing over lunch. They've spent 3 days learning why diversity and inclusion are essential for growing talent and bolstering Maine's shrinking workforce.
The solution that is really available to the state is people from diverse backgrounds that are interested in coming to the United States and making Maine home.
Muhammad Hamza Khan is the founder of Inclusion Maine. He was born in Pakistan and came to the U.S. in 2005. He says he was reluctant to use his full name on job applications because he never heard back from employers. For that reason, he decided networking was important for immigrants in the workforce. The state estimates an additional 75,000 skilled professionals will be needed by 2029. Barb Stoddard, program coordinator at the New Mainer Resource Center, says New Mainers are often highly skilled, underemployed, and could help fill the gap.
We recognize the need of the labor force and the labor shortages in Maine, and I think that we also recognize the importance of inclusive work environments and welcoming people and having people feel like they belong.
Khan's work to diversify the labor force has hit some roadblocks under the new administration. The conference was originally scheduled for February, but after a flurry of President Trump's anti-DEI executive orders in January, organizers decided to push it back. Ahmed Khan, Muhammad's brother and consultant for Inclusion Maine, says it didn't feel like the right time.
There was a lot of media attention. You know, we didn't want to be in legal trouble in any way, and moving it was the right choice. Just so things calmed down a little bit.
No sponsors dropped out, and Muhammad Khan says attendance was on par with last year. Nate Moody, a partner at LaBelle and Harriman Financial Services, says despite the federal policy changes, the tone of the conference was hopeful.
It's really been, if anything, like a very uniting aspect to the conference this year is the fact that, like, hey, we're all in this together. We're all rowing in the same direction. And if anything, it's really, like, magnetized the importance of something like this.
Muhammad says there is good reason to hope in Maine because, for the most part, employers across the state have not stopped doing this work. He says some have changed language to avoid being targeted by the Trump administration. But if those shifts allow organizations to continue doing the work, that's fine by him.
If you use the word diversity, equity, and inclusion, that's amazing. You know, of course, that's what we're working towards. But if you're using the words workforce development or you're using the words, you know, like inclusive hiring or recruiting, all of those, at the end of the day, we're moving towards the same direction.
Despite changes to language and federal policy, Muhammad says efforts to diversify Maine's workforce will continue.
No matter what happens with the federal policy shift, the need for talent in the state has not changed.
Muhammad says he is already planning next year's conference, which will return to its usual spring dates. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Maddie Smith.
It's been a challenging week for lifeguards in southern Maine, who've had to make several rescues in powerful rip currents. two challenging scenes involved the rescue of 9 children by Algonquin lifeguards in dangerous, fast-moving currents. Carol Bousquet has more.
On Monday, a day at the beach in Algonquin turned into a life-saving rescue for 4 children swept into the ocean on paddle boards. Matt Pooler is the lifeguard captain.
Where they are, the way the tide was moving, we recognize that as a situation that can develop into something that's a little more urgent. So we recognize that we need to use our jet ski to get over there and assist.
In just minutes, the jet ski reached the frightened kids and lifeguards began scooping them up while EMTs waited on the shore to check them out.
I was really proud of that rescue. Everything from our first year guard over on the riverside calling it in to us handing off to EMS when everyone executed on their training very well.
Pooler says parents need to be more aware of what the hazards are, provide their kids with life jackets, and have them swim closer to shore. Lifeguard Lieutenant Gracie Jordan says flotation devices aren't safe in certain conditions.
Floats create a false confidence in people because you feel safe that you have a flotation device, but the ocean isn't still. It's always moving, and there's always factors that can ruin your day very quickly.
Another rescue on Wednesday took place at the other end of Algonquin Beach. 5 children were in trouble, with 1 lifeguard helping them stay afloat until the jet ski could arrive. Lifeguard Aiden Paniton said 1 child got separated from the group.
They were probably in the worst scenario because they were getting kind of dragged underneath the water. So we went and we scooped up that first one that got pulled away. We went back, got another one out of the group. We had a guard that was already in the water that kind of stabilized the 4 of them.
Algonquin Fire Chief Russ Osgood says they have fewer lifeguards this season because of budget cuts.
We did have to remove 1 stand, but these guards have been doing a phenomenal job with even more beach to protect.
Kennebunk Fire and Rescue also has fewer lifeguards this summer. They have 15 full and part-time guards. 10 are required to staff both Gooch's and Mother's Beaches. On this day, a few are out, so the Mother's Beach post remains empty. Deputy Fire Chief Bo Gleason says he's heard complaints from concerned residents, but he has to make a judgment call on which beach to staff. And Mother's, with its gradual slope and protective rocks, has no rip currents.
Gooch's has a far worse rip current than mm-hmm. Mother's does. Gooch's has far more people that don't want to adhere to the rules and ordinances. One is you can't drink alcohol on the beach. Mm-hmm. You know, 70% of drownings are attributed to alcohol.
Gleason asks beachgoers to put themselves in the shoes of lifeguards who are there to protect them. It is estimated that 100 people are killed by rip currents annually, according to data from the U.S. Lifesaving Association. Lifeguards say if you are caught in a rip current, swim parallel to shore and swim back to land at an angle. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Carol Bousquet.
When it comes to the effects of rising prices for goods and services, food pantries are on the front lines. Nowhere is that more evident than in rural Washington County, which has the highest food insecurity rate in New England. As Caitlin Badayan reports, the Trump administration's cuts to federal food programs are already forcing pantries there to make hard choices.
At the Machias Area Food Pantry, Amber Ross and her 2 daughters are bagging up their groceries. It's almost an hour drive for the family to get here, Ross says, but it's a highlight for her young girls.
And it's nice being able to come here because every once in a while they have something that my kids would consider a treat. And so they have little gummies, they have little things that make it feel like I'm giving my kids something more than just the basics.
The family of 6 has been regularly coming to the pantry for about 2 years. Ross says she's a stay-at-home mom and runs an online business. Even with her business and her husband's job, rising prices were stretching their monthly budget.
When you can take a little bit of the load off the grocery budget, it's a lot easier to move it towards other things.
As a state, Maine has the highest rate of food insecurity in New England. And according to the Good Shepherd Food Bank, Washington County, Maine, has the highest rate of all counties in the region. About 18% of individuals and 27% of children are considered food insecure.
So food insecurity means that you have
either limited access or uncertain access to adequate food.
Robin McCarthy is Chief Advancement Officer with Good Shepherd Food Bank.
If you have a utility bill that's due that week, you might shop for groceries differently than if you don't, as opposed to when somebody is food secure, they have access to all the nutritious, healthy food that they want, and they don't have to make those trade-offs.
Those trade-offs mean that food pantries are often the first to see the impacts of rising prices and program cuts across household budgets.
We are definitely serving the working poor.
Ken Warner and Nancy Lewis are the co-directors of the Machias Area Food Pantry. Warner says more than half of the pantry's clients are less than 50 years old, and like those at other food pantries, many are employed.
You know, the budgets just don't stretch far enough. I mean, you know, you used to think $15 an hour you could live on. They can't live on $15 an hour, and that's about the top pay around here.
Lewis says new clients will sometimes say they never thought they'd have to go to the food pantry.
A lot of people have to choose between whether they get their medication, pay the utility bill, pay the phone bill, or eat. And it's a very difficult decision for them.
The pantry is now seeing about 180 households a week, and the number of meals served has almost doubled from last year. Because of the jump in need, Lewis says they have had to restrict services to residents from 11 nearby towns.
So we've had to tell people that we'll give them a bag of food, we'll give them food for that day, but that they have to go to a pantry that is more local.
In Calais, Dawn Noonan with the Irene Chadbourne Ecumenical Food Pantry says they have had to do the same thing.
If they're not on the list, you can't do it. We're able to, at some point, be able to give them a small amount, maybe two or three cans or, you know, and they got families, and I hate saying I can't help you, but we can't. Because we have to save the food here for our people.
Noonan says the pantry gets food directly from the Federal Emergency Food Assistance Program, or TFAP. But that program has seen cuts, along with the amount of free food the pantry receives. Noonan used to refuse some of the food she knew might sit on the pantry shelves for a while. But now she's taking anything she can get, trying to prepare for more uncertainty.
I don't know what's going to happen down the road. I really do not know. I want to make sure we have enough food.
And she says she's been warning people to expect less. The Calais and Machias pantries aren't alone in seeing more clients and less food. Robin McCarthy of Good Shepherd says with more federal cuts going into effect in the coming months and years, she expects it will become more challenging.
We'll see a steep increase in people who are not receiving SNAP, and thus they're going to need more from their food pantries. And at the same time, food pantries are struggling with the same thing that a lot of those families are. Food costs more and it's harder for them to get.
Ken Warner of the Machias Food Pantry says no matter what happens, his and other food pantries will be looking for ways to continue to help people.
Because these folks need it.
For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Caitlin Bedayan.
And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. Join us tomorrow morning at 8 for Weekend Edition on Maine Public Radio. I'm Ari Snyder. Thanks for listening.